I'm speaking with Happy Rhodes, who is kind enough to sit with me for an interview in celebration of her new album, Find Me, released just a few months ago. So let's start. I'm going to start at the beginning, since even though I'm sure a lot of your very ardent fans will be listening, there are probably going to be people listening who aren't that familiar with you. So let's begin with when you first started getting interested in music as an audience member and then as a performer.
Wow. That would have been very, very early, I think. First started getting interested in music. Well, just for simplicity's sake, I would say I was introduced to the guitar by my mom. She had an old beat-up guitar. It was a nylon string. And, you know, she could play a few chords. And I picked up her guitar and would just, you know, plunk around on it. And she would show me how to do a G chord. She'd show me how to do a D chord. And I think I was probably about 9 or 10 at the time. And I've always been heavy into music because my father used to play music every weekend in the house. So I had been exposed to a lot of different artists, including a lot of classical music. So then I got interested in the guitar just because it was just the first instrument I was introduced to. So I guess within about 6 months or so, my mom just gave me that guitar to have, which was like the coolest thing that ever happened to me, and I just immediately started finger picking. I had one lesson on guitar, and it was like a group lesson with a bunch of students at my school, and the lesson was on strumming, and strumming like folk music, and I hated folk music, and I just said, I'm not going to do that, so I immediately started finger picking, and it took off from there. The performance aspect of music for me was never... I didn't even come up until I was about, I don't know, 16 or 17 when I started doing open mic nights at Cafe Lena in Saratoga. And that was petrifying for me. It was just terrifying because I didn't like singing in front of people. I'm one of those kind of people that I want everything to be absolutely perfect before I present it, whether it's, you know, some craft that I've just done or some technical thing I've done or a song or whatever. I just always want it to be, if it can't be perfect, there's no sense in, you know, putting it out there. So I was petrified to play in front of people, but Cafe Lena was my first foray into that realm. It's never been a huge, huge love of mine. I like creating music a lot more than I do performing it, but it's a package deal.
What sort of music did you enjoy growing up?
Well, let's see. I mean, I'm kind of an unusual case because I didn't actually start purchasing music as a kid until I was about 14 years old. I guess maybe 13 or 14. I mean, I understand kids these days, you know, can download whatever they want and just listen to music all the time. But when I was of age to be able to start purchasing LPs, it would have been Queen. It would have been Queen, and more Queen. I was a Queen freak. So that's what I was listening to mostly at that age. Before that, it was pretty varied. You know, I loved a lot of stuff on the radio. I would listen to the radio a lot, and occasionally I would try to tape some great song that I loved off of the radio.
I was a big fan of News of the World, so I totally get what you're saying. When did you first discover the extent of your vocal range? One of the things that you're renowned for is your very sweeping, I think it's 4-octave range. So when did you first realize that you had all of that room there?
Well, I didn't always have that room. I mean, I had to develop it. I'm naturally an alto, as you can hear in my voice. And, of course, throughout school, I was always in the choirs and everything, and I was always stuck as an alto, but it was frustrating for me because there's a breaking point in everyone's voice where you go from your, you know, regular voice to a falsetto, and my breaking point happens very, very low in my register. I have a deep, deep voice, and that's my natural range. So I had to actually develop my higher range. And I did that just by singing along with Kate Bush records. I mean, that's if you want to develop a high range, that's the thing to do.
Especially the first couple.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, singing along with Queen, obviously, is the same thing. It's like, you know, Roger Taylor could hit notes that, you know, would make my grandmother cry. So it's I sang along with Queen, I sang along with Kate Bush, and what else? Later in life, when I started getting more into Yes, I would sing along with John Anderson. So, you know, that was how I developed my upper range. And, of course, in order to get those high notes, I probably did all the wrong things. I would kind of constrict my air and not sing out, just kind of constrict everything so I could, like, get that high pitch. And as time went on, after I started getting my voice used to being up there, I started trying to sing more healthily, you know, like opening up a little bit more so it doesn't damage your voice.
Well, you mentioned Yes, which is right down the pike for our station. We're a progressive rock radio station. So yeah. Sets up my next question perfectly, which is which progressive bands, I would say if any, but I know you're a big fan of Yes, which progressive bands would you say are your favorites and which ones influenced you? And sort of how did you come across them and when, and sort of as much as you can think of as progressive music slamming into your music and that sort of thing?
Well, let me see if I'm understanding your question. You're asking which progressive band or bands had the biggest impact on my writing?
Both impact on your writing, and which do you like? Do you still listen to any of them? And kind of when did you start listening to progressive music, and how do you think it's influenced your work? And do you still listen to it?
Yeah, well, interestingly enough, I listen to very little music anymore, even the music that I love. I don't know why. I'm not the kind of person that walks into the house after a long day and, you know, throws on a CD. I just don't do that. But I would say that having two older brothers growing up, I got exposed to some interesting stuff. I very much liked Pink Floyd. I don't know how much Pink Floyd influenced my writing. I would have to say probably not very much at all, but I definitely was exposed to a lot of Pink Floyd. Later, it was Yes, and in particular, an album that really, really made a huge impact on me was Olaus Isonhilo, which is John Anderson's solo, one of his solo albums. I think his first solo album.
Yeah, I just picked up a remaster of that. Actually, it's pretty good.
Yeah. Well, that's a trippy album and has a lot going on, and I really appreciated that. Because my thing about music when I was growing up is I just needed to be challenged. I don't want to hear, you know, I don't want to hear fluff. I don't want to hear easy pop songs. I want to hear things that challenge my brain so that when you're listening to it, you're trying to pick out parts. And that's why I loved Queen so much, of course, because they were just ridiculous when it came to vocal parts and musical parts. So I would say that definitely, Yes, specifically John Anderson. I also loved Chris Squire's solo work. I was exposed to the Straubs. I'm trying to think. Oh, there's so many. But the ones that really, really stuck with me were the ones that wound up with the longevity, and that would be Yes.
Have you ever seen them?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
They're still actually really, really good. I saw them on the 2003 tour, and they could still tear it up pretty well.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, well, I mean, you know, this might surprise and shock a lot of people, but I'm also a huge Trevor Rabin fan. I just happen to think he's a genius. Nothing against Steve Howe at all. I mean, I love Steve Howe, too. But Trevor Rabin, I mean, his solo album, what's it called? No, I can't even remember. Can't Look Away, I think. That is just an incredible record. I mean, in terms of, that's not progressive, but it's definitely deep pop. It's not fluff at all. It's definitely intricate and intense music. And so I always enjoy listening to him. And I've enjoyed seeing Yes with Trevor. I've enjoyed seeing them with Steve. So it's all great for me.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your songwriting process, if that's okay.
Sure.
What drives you to write? What drives you after you've written to actually decide, okay, it's time to start recording? And why did you start, well, looking back to your history, let's cover that one first. Sorry, so many questions. So what drives you to write, and then what drives you to record after you've written?
Well, the thing is that my process is basically I write as I record, because usually, you know, some people like do demos and then you take it into the studio and it gets produced. Basically, what I do is I write into the directly into the computer, and most of what I write winds up being the song. With the exception of this last album, I would write everything into the computer. Everything that was electronic stayed original to what I had done. Anything that needed to be live, like we decided drums and, you know, live guitars and so on, those, of course, would then be translated. But in many cases, let's see, one song in particular on Find Me was Queen. That song, I wrote all the guitar parts into the computer, but they wound up being duplicated live by a very talented player named Teddy Kumpel. So when I'm recording at the same time that I'm writing, and what drives me to start a song in the first place, I mean, who knows? It could be anything. Basically, most of the time, it's some weird, anomalous electronic thing that I've just come up with that I think is just so cool that maybe I can base a song around it. So I never write lyrics first. I mean, that's so rare for me, because I don't feel like, it's not like I have some great things to say to people. I don't actually feel that I do, but I feel like I have a lot of music in me. So when I start writing the music, then usually the theme or the feeling of the music is what's going to dictate what the song is about.
When did you first start, or I guess both when and why did you first start recording? I know it was back in the early 80s. What inspired you to say, okay, well, I have these songs, I should actually record them?
Well, I knew I wanted to be a recording artist, so to speak. Had no idea how I was going to do that, seeing as how, you know, I was pretty darn shy at the time, and antisocial, and had I didn't know anybody. How was I going to, like, get money? Here I am, 18 years old. How am I going to get money to record an album? So I decided that I would go to a local recording studio and just kind of walk in and ask if I could be, like, an apprentice, like, just work there for free and learn how things get recorded. And I just, I don't know, in some weird way, I thought that would help open doors for me. If I could just learn how recording works, then, then maybe I can get a foot in somewhere. And I toyed with the idea of just learning to become an engineer, and just, you know, instead of music, or maybe just try to do them both. But what happened was I walked into a studio in Rensselaer, New York, and the head engineer there was Pat Tessitore, and, he agreed to let me just hang out and watch. There wasn't really much I could do. I wasn't really an apprentice, but I could just hang and, you know, learn from him. And as a lesson, as my first lesson, as a matter of fact, he said, well, you're a musician, so why don't you bring in your guitar? At the time, I only had a guitar. I had no electronics or anything. He said, bring in your guitar, and we'll put you in the booth, and you can play, you know, whatever. We'll record a couple songs, and you'll learn how it works. So I did. I brought in my guitar, started singing, and he recorded me, and I came out, and he just looked at me, and he said, you're not going to be an engineer. I said, what? He goes, how many more songs do you have? And I said, well, I've got quite a few. And he goes, we're going to start recording your songs. And, I mean, that was just the kindness of his heart. He just, for free now, just started recording everything I wrote. And it was great. I mean, and those sessions wound up being the first two, probably more than the first two, but basically the first two albums of mine, which are Rhodes 1 and Rhodes 2, they're just a compilation of all these little tunes that I wrote when I was young, you know?
So you have these albums and they're on cassette. How did you imagine they would find an audience, or did you worry about that at all?
Well, when I first started releasing them, it was very early in the days. I don't know if CDs were... They were just coming out, probably, and it was, you know, early. And I don't know, I mean, I don't know if I thought that I would eventually wind up on a major label and, you know, things would take off from there. I don't really remember what I was thinking, but at the time, the label that I was on was Oral Gratification, by owned by Kevin Bartlett, and basically we would just have the cassettes available in local stores and stuff. But what happened was certain people, certain acquaintances would get a copy of a cassette and then dub it, you know, make a compilation, and then send somebody else a cassette and say, oh, you might want to check out this artist, you know, track number 4 is Happy Road, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, things would start happening. That's how Vicky Mapes wound up getting my music, because I think someone had sent her a cassette of a compilation, and I was one of the songs on it. So it just took off. I didn't plan anything. I didn't really think anything out. It's just sometimes if things are meant to happen, they're going to happen.
Okay. And then with War Paint, you start the magic of compact discs became
right.
available.
And right. Incidentally, War Paint was actually the first album that I wrote all the music specifically to release for that CD, as opposed to the first 4 were compilations of just songs that I had recorded, you know, through the years.
And was War Paint the first one that actually had a photograph as a cover?
Well, they all had photographs, but they were photographs taken by me of paintings that I had done. So, but yeah, that War Paint was the first one that actually had a professional photograph of my face on the cover.
Okay, your compilations that you've released are also really interesting, like. The Road Song with Ashes to Ashes, and then The Keep with the Yes medley.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Do you enjoy performing other artists' songs as well, just kind of sitting around, or, you know, even recording them or performing them live? Is that something that you like doing?
It's something I like doing if it's something that really moves me. Like, one of my favorite writers is actually Neil Finn. I just... and Tim Finn, too. I mean, both of them, they're just amazing writers. So so I just loved the song Don't Dream It's Over. Felt like doing that live just because I think it's a beautiful song. And I'm obviously not the only person who thinks that, because it's been covered quite a number of times. So, yeah, I mean, just any... If I really, really like a song, like I really love... like I love Run to Me by the Bee Gees. I mean, it's the Bee Gees, but, you know, it's a great song. I love that song. So, you know, every time I feel moved by someone's song, I'll do it. But again, it's like, because I don't buy music a lot, and I don't listen to a lot of new stuff. I probably should, but I don't. So anything that I'm going to do a cover of, it's probably going to be something pretty old.
Well, I did notice, by the way, that on The Keep, your Yes medley is 3/4 Trevor Rabin song. So definitely no worries about where your interests lie as far as that's concerned.
Somebody's got to do it.
Yeah. Well, it's a shame that whole era seems to be consigned to the gated drums equals bad part of musical history now. That sort of... revisionism that says that the Yes that included Trevor Rabin was not the real one and they were terrible, et cetera, et cetera. If Trevor Rabin hadn't come along, none of these guys would have jobs. It's unfortunate, but, you know, he really did revitalize them in a way that, and I agree with you, he's an amazing pop writer and producer, so.
Yeah, I mean, just the sheer talent that the guy has, because, I mean, he can sing, he can... I mean, how many instruments can the guy play? He's very, very accomplished. So I think he deserves everything that he has.
So did you decide... I mean, so you, at that point, decided, okay, put down the engineering staff, so to speak, and just concentrate on recording the songs. So you produce yourself, though, most of the time, or have in the past produced yourself. What do you see as the difference between being the producer... and being the engineer? Because there are some people, like, for instance, Steve Albini, who says, no, I flip the switches and that's my job. And then there are other people, like, let's say, Mutt Lange. Producer means everything up to and including writing the songs and taking 500 takes to get a drum sound right. Where do you see your world of production in that?
Yeah, well, That's very true. I mean, it's got to be the same in film, too. Pete, it's really hard to define the word producer. Everybody has their own definition of it. Producer could mean you're the money person. You're the person who picks up the phone and, you know, calls all the contacts and gets all the right people together and so on and so forth. In music, generally, the producer is the person who, you know, hears the raw demo of a song and decides the direction of it and decides what kind of musicians should be on it and all that stuff. For me, again, because I record as I write, I also produce as I write. This last album, Find Me, is produced by Bob Mueller, and I totally took a hands-off approach to this. I gave him, you know, it's like I present all my material to him. I mean, there were times when, and this is unusual for me, but there were times when he would say, this song needs to be reworked. I think you need to, you know, make the chorus longer. You need to do this, or this needs another section. Write a new section for this. And I'm always very resistant to anybody telling me what I should do for a song. But I stayed very open to comments and suggestions on this one and usually did everything that he asked. And it's great because it still all wound up coming from me. He's the producer, but he didn't write anything. I wrote everything. And most of the stuff that I presented him is still the same, but, you know, that's the difference. And in the past, producing myself, it's not always a good idea for one to produce oneself, I think, because I think in the past I would have disagreed with myself. I would have said, hey, I'm always going to produce myself. But it's not always the best thing for an artist. You know, it's good to have other people, you know, a third opinion, a second opinion, whatever.
So you feel like having that sort of outside ear helped you clarify some things maybe that wouldn't have come to light otherwise?
Well, sure. I mean, there are so many decisions that I made about my music in the past that I, you know, I look back and go, oh man, that was goofy. What the hell did I do that for? And if I had like just listened to somebody or had somebody telling me, you know, this is a really corny sound, you really don't want to use that, then it would have been better. But hey, that's the way it goes.
So why don't we talk about the recording process of Find Me? When did you start working on it?
Oh, I started writing it probably 98, 99. But I was actually still writing for the album up until, when would that have been? I don't know, probably 2003, still writing on it. The only reason that I normally would never take that long to do an album, but the studio that I was recording at, of course, the owner of the studio is Bob Mueller, who also produced the album. He's also my husband. And obviously I wasn't paying anything to the studio for recording there. But the price you pay for not paying for studio time is that when paying clients do come in, and it was quite a very successful, busy studio, you have to make way for the paying clients. So my recording schedule had to, you know, revolve around all of that. And that made it really, really difficult. So it wound up taking a very long time, and that's probably the only reason why I was still writing in 2003 or whatever.
Were you recording all this time, or did you wait until you finished the writing to start the studio-based recordings of the re-singing of the vocals and the live guitar?
No, I had been writing. I mean, for me, it's like, I don't always write. Like, some people are just always writing, and then they'll, you know, compile what they've written thus far and, you know, work it into a CD. I only write when I'm ready to make a CD. And then I sit down and I start writing. So when I started writing for this next one, it was with the intention of you know, putting out my 11th CD. So no, I didn't wait until the studio time was opening up. I had to get it all written first and then, you know, start working on it.
Did you work on it all the time? For instance, you wrote the song, and then, okay, well, now I want to go sing the vocals, so there's a bit of time here. So you've been working on it all this time. It hasn't been, well, I took 4 years off and then started recording.
Oh, no, yeah,
again.
Right. No. I mean, it was dribs and drabs. It was like always working on something. Until it got to the point where the recording was done. The recording and the mixing was done. Then a huge time lapse happened because we were having a lot of problems getting a right mastering engineer for it. And by then we had moved out of New York and out into the country, and I had to get the artwork done. So it's like the album itself was finished and sat for a long time without any forward progression because the mastering was such a pain. And a few songs had to be reworked a little bit and remixed, and that took a long time as well because we're doing it now long distance. It's not like we were in New York at the studio anymore. So for me, the artwork in particular, because I'm, you know, it's like usually, with the exception of Many Worlds Were Born Tonight, usually I am solely responsible for the artwork. And because finishing the CD, not recording it, but finishing the CD in terms of, you know, now it was out of my hands. I did all my work was done, and now it needed to be mastered and remixed on some songs and blah, blah, blah. So now I'm idle and I'm free to go on with my life, but I was, taking my sweet time getting the artwork done because it wasn't coming up. There was no pressure to do it. It's just like, and I wasn't quite sure what I wanted the concept to be, and you know, still, I didn't know, you know, how the album was going to sound put all together in the right order. And sometimes, you know, sometimes you have to wait until all that's done before you can figure out, okay, this is what it should look like. But something came up. I had a show coming up, and we decided that I should really haul and get the artwork finished quickly. And I did just that. I mean, it was like the quickest artwork job I've ever done in my life, and it just wound up being all my drawings, because where I'm living now, the talent pool for photographers, good photographers, is yet untapped. I don't know anybody around here, and I'm not sure there are talented photographers around here. They probably are, but because when you're in the country, it takes a lot longer to network. And I just didn't really have the time or energy to go traveling to New York and do that whole thing. So I just, all the artwork I needed, I just took my own photographs and I drew my own pictures and slapped it together.
Wasn't that sort of the modus operandi for almost all of your albums? Up until Many Worlds, you were sort of responsible for the artwork and the packaging for those as well?
Absolutely, yeah.
So you're an old hand at it, perhaps. So that's probably why you're able to get it done so quickly.
I guess so. It was certainly the concept that came about certainly wound up being a surprise to me. I mean, originally it was going to be something completely different, but you know, when you can only rely on your own resources, sometimes you just have to go with the flow.
So as I was mentioning, I really love the electronic sounds on the new album. To get a little nerdish here, what sort of instruments do you use when you're recording?
Well, now you're going to force me to try and remember what I did, which is not going to be easy. My absolute favorite thing to mess around with is, two things I would say. One is the Wave Station, I think it's Korg Wave Station, which is ridiculously hard to find anymore. It's a pretty rare item.
Is that the M1 or?
No, Wave Station. It's actually a rack unit.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
it does incredible things. I mean, when it first came out, it was kind of overused, and you could recognize a Wave Station sound immediately. I kind of think it's limitless in terms of what the weird things you can do with it if you're patient. And that's one thing I have is patience. I will sit in front of an electronic box for hours and days if it takes it, just to get a weird, unrecognizable sound. And my other favorite thing is my G-Force, which is an effects unit, which is actually meant for guitar, but I use it on everything.
So you're completely unafraid of using an effects unit on vocals, drums, anything. So,
it's I consider it another instrument.
Do you usually? I think if I understand correctly, you have these things at home and can just go nuts whenever you have an idea. Is that right? So, does that lead you? Do you find to spending a lot more time on a song than you would if, let's say, you had to pay to go in and you had an hour with the wave station? Gives you more sort of impetus to do lots of interesting things?
Well, I mean, yeah, obviously. I don't know anybody, though, who is in a position to be able to pay to go into a studio to write. I mean, these days, it's just like, well, first of all, there are no studios left. I mean, half the studios in New York City closed down in the last 5 years. But, I mean, you know, if you're going to, you have to do that at home. You have to have the gear in your hands, in your home to do that, because you really do need to spend time if you have the patience. If I didn't have that stuff at home, I mean, I don't know. My writing style would be completely different if I had to actually go somewhere else to do it.
Well, I know that you have a very, very ardent fan base. In fact, the mailing list Ecto is named for one of your early albums.
Mm-hmm.
The internet and you. What has been the effect of the internet on your career?
Well, it's made my career. I wouldn't have a career if it weren't for the internet. And, you know, I must say, people like Jessica Demski and Vicky Mapes, I mean, these are people who latched onto my music and started getting the word out in a big way. And to this day, Vicky Mapes is still pushing my career. I mean, it's, whatever my career is, it is because largely of Vicky Mapes and her efforts. So, I mean, when this whole thing started, I didn't even know what the internet was. I didn't... obviously, I had a computer, but had no, you know, all I did with the computer was make music, so it was all a mystery to me.
Do you find yourself being interested in sort of getting involved with that fan community in a more interactive way, or would it be better to just let them sort of enjoy the music as they want to?
I think it's not my style. I mean, when I say I'm antisocial, I'm pretty serious about that. I don't mean that I'm antisocial in terms of I can't get along in society. I can, but I can't be around people too much because I kind of feel like I get very, very affected on a personal level by people. Not necessarily in a bad way, but like if I'm having a conversation with someone. Let's say I have an hour-long conversation with someone. That conversation will stay with me for the rest of the night. I'll think about it, and I'll, you know, just constantly brew on it. And because people affect me, you know, it's just I really like to listen to people. I like to learn about their lives, but I can only take so much because I become saturated. I really do take in so much. So I kind of feel like I'm better off, and everyone else is better off if I just kind of stay with my quiet life and let everybody just independently enjoy what I've done. I'm always open to comments or you know, questions or anything like that. I'm really happy to talk to people, but I don't put myself out there actively.
And that kind of brings me to a question about live performance. I know that you perform occasionally, but not a whole lot. I saw you at Ecto West, which I think was in 2001 or 2002, mm-hmm. with the unfortunate incident with the Leatherman tool. but you still did a great set. Do you, for the new CD, are you planning any live performances outside of the Ecto Fest appearance you made earlier this year?
Let's just say I'm open to it. I haven't actively started planning anything yet. It's kind of like I finished the CD so abruptly, so kind of quickly, just so I could have it available for the Ectofest 2007, that now that it's out, of course, that question is coming up, and I haven't had a chance to get my head around it yet. It's, you know, it's a little harder because my husband and I also... my husband owns and runs Dangerous Music, which is an equipment company. Now it's an equipment company. We manufacture pro audio equipment. I actually work for the company. So, and, you know, I'm 42 now, and we have a house, and, you know, so it's like the thought of doing any kind of intensive touring is a little daunting and probably impractical at this point. But I understand the importance of supporting the CD now that it's officially out. So I will probably plan something. I'm not sure how soon, but it'll happen.
So do you enjoy, when you do have a performance schedule, do you enjoy performing live?
I do. You know, I really only enjoy performing live when I feel prepared. And there have been times, most recently, ECBFest 2007, when I've just not really, my head just wasn't there and I wasn't really prepared. Then it just becomes nerve-wracking for me. But if I feel prepared, yeah, I feel great. And I'm kind of, I'm also kind of tired of performing acoustically because it's like, especially with this Find Me CD, there's really not much acoustic about it. It's pretty, you know, it's rock. It's rock and electronic, and I kind of like, for once, would like to get out there with a band again and not just, you know, do a duo or a trio. And I've done that. I've done that a million times, and I'm kind of tired of it now. So, and again, I'm in the country, so all of my musical contacts are mostly based in New York at this point, and so in order to coordinate something, I'm going to have to hook up with these people again. So,
well, let's talk a little bit about the new CD, if we can. As you said, it's sort of filled with rock and electronics, yet there's still a couple of very, well, I don't want to say acoustic, but very ballad-based, like, sort of like The Chosen One. And definitely The Chosen One, which is a more acoustic type of song. Do you find that you really enjoy playing the rocking stuff better, or the acoustic, or is it...
Yeah. You mean live?
No, when you're recording, do you find that you have sort of a drive to make things loud and, for lack of a better word, Queen-like?
Actually, yeah. I mean, it's in a live setting, it's having loud is a pain in the ass because it's just I don't happen to have a very strong voice. Just sheer power-wise, I don't have a very strong voice. So when the band has to be loud to push, you know, to rock out, it's really difficult for me to compete or to keep up with that vocally. So it's a drag sometimes live. Studio-wise, however, it's just, if I were mixing my own, like this for Find Me, if I were mixing the record, all of the drums and all of the bass would be completely overshadowing the vocals. I mean, I would just crank them because I just love it. You know, it's like, when you hear, you know, live drums, live bass, live guitar, it's just an amazing thing.
Well, you talked a little bit about performing live by yourself. What about, I think you participated in sort of being a side person for Project Low a few mm-hmm. years ago. Did you find that kind of more entertaining, and is there anything of that nature sort of hovering in the future where you sort of just are with other people, touring with other people or playing out with them?
Well, I mean, I loved playing in Project Low mostly because it wasn't about me, you know? It's just like really, when you spend your whole life being Happy Rhodes or whoever you are, and, you know, it's all about you, and, you know, you've got a band backing up you, it's like really nice to just be part of something that's not about you anymore. You're just a supporting player. That's that made it pretty fun for me. And also, I just adore Bon Lazaga and Hanny Rowe. I mean, they're like two of my best friends, so it's always fun hanging with those guys. In terms of doing more of that kind of stuff in the future, I'm not usually asked. I mean, I have been asked to participate in some projects that I've turned down because I didn't feel like I would bring anything useful to that particular project. But, one, I'm not going out seeking projects with other musicians, and two, nobody's really seeking me out. So I'm open. I'm open to just about anything.
Okay. Well, that's good to hear. It sounds more sort of like David Bowie on the Idiot Tour for Iggy Pop, where he just sort of played keyboards and did backing vocals.
Right.
But that would be kind of a cool thing for you.
Yeah, that would be.
You mentioned a while back perhaps another bit of music coming up. In other words, are you starting to think about your next CD at all, or putting some something on?
I'm not thinking about it because, I mean, again, I don't really, until I sit down in front of the instruments, I don't usually feel much. But basically, I just feel like a drive inside me, not any ideas necessarily, but I feel a drive, and I'm starting to feel that drive again. I can't start writing just yet because the studio is not finished. It's not quite put together yet. There's still, I mean, I have to get a new recording platform. So, but once that happens, I'm there. I'm sitting down, and I'll start, and we'll see what's going to. But I think it's going to be probably more of a, I don't know how I'd put it. I'm going to make it a little bit more outside. It's not going to be anything like Find Me. It probably won't have that sort, same sort of progressive-ish live instrumentation feel to it. It's going to be, hopefully, a little more off-center.
Do you have sort of an interest in, for lack of a better word, avant-garde electronic music that might inform that? I noticed a sort of a bit of that on Find Me, and we were talking about the Wave Station. Sort of, for lack of a better word, non-traditional sounds. Do you find any kind of influence from... well, I think I read somewhere that you were a big fan of Switched On Bach growing up, and did you follow that sort of Wendy Carlos, that sort of thing at all?
The whole Switched On Bach thing, which I was introduced to pretty early on, I thought that was freaking amazing. I thought, like, here's this classical piece of music being played with this with electronics. I thought, wow, that is so weird and so cool. So I've always been fascinated with that, and I've always been drawn to, you know, artists who use cool electronics. You know, I'm not, unlike you, I'm kind of, I have gotten way more heavy into, you know, just in terms of being attracted to electronic music. But I'm trying to think of, aside from Switched On Bach, they were, I mean, everyone was, I mean, Kate Bush and Peter Gabriel, you know, huge innovators there. What was the band? I'm trying to think of the band's name that I loved so much. Non-vocal band. It was just instrumental electronic music. Very, very cool. I can't think of it right now, but it was definitely a big thing for me.
Do you ever...
Art of Noise.
Art of Noise. Oh, okay, yeah. Oh, they are, sort of a tangential Yes connection. Trevor Horn producing them and so forth. And their first album is just amazing. Mm-hmm. The whole idea of taking a Fairlight and turning it into the only instrument you need was kind of an exceptional innovation at the time.
Yeah.
What sort of things do you do when you're not making music?
Well, I build pro audio gear, and I watch movies. I'm a big movie fan, and I just try to keep creative. I mean, I like to do all kinds of, like right now I'm actually constructing a very scary witch for my front lawn so I can freak out the country folk.
For Halloween, I assume?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I made a witch last year. It was kind of like, I kept it really tame because I didn't want to scare anybody, you know, it's... But this year, I'm going to try to make it good and scary just because that's what I do. I like monsters, so. But I'm just trying to stay creative. You know, I like little projects. I like to hand-make things.
Have you thought about some sort of art exhibit for your work? Because I know that the people who enjoy your music are also big fans of your art, as evidenced on your covers. So have you ever thought about putting something, an exhibition together?
Well, I appreciate that question, but I think my type of artwork could only be exhibited like in a Kmart or something, because really, honestly, for one, I'm a horrible painter. I can't paint worth anything. And, I mean, my skills are very, very raw. I have nothing's refined. I can draw like the Dickens. I mean, I can do a portrait of somebody in pastel, and it's going to be look just like them. It's like amazing. But my technique is really bad, you know, with all across the board. It's like I have the basic skills of drawing, but my techniques are really bad. So, no, I would never exhibit anything. But what I would like to do is get more heavily into doing art. I mean, I made a sculpture out of circuit boards of a moth, and was kind of proud of that. I thought it was a pretty cool thing. So I want to do more sort of circuit board sculptures of things, and I want to get back into painting, definitely. So I'd like to do more.
Okay. Let's talk just a bit more about the new CD. I know I keep flashing back and forth to it. There have been some questions that about specific songs, and the one that I think about is The Chosen One, because the lyrics are sort of about the lead character of the song feels like she's never going to be to find a happy relationship. And as you said, you're married, and so do you find that throughout your writing, you've written from character viewpoints, from your own viewpoint, from both, and how do you sort of reconcile people who might say, well, you wrote that song, but you're happily married. Is there something wrong? Is something up? That sort of thing.
Okay, well, first of all, I wasn't married when I wrote that song. And because I only just got married last year.
Oh, well, mazel tov.
Thanks. No, my husband and I have been together for 9 years, but we only just got married last year. But this last CD, Find Me in particular, is probably more personal than anything else I've done, even more personal than my early stuff. It's all from my personal point of view. If I'm using the word I or me, it's going to be about me. It's going to be personal. And Chosen One was basically, you know, I just like a little insecurity. It's like I never wanted to be married. My entire life, I never found it an important aspect of my life. I've never been like the kind of girl who always dreamt about her wedding day and wanted to plan everything. And in fact, when I got married, I didn't plan anything. It just wasn't a big deal to me. But what I did want and long for was the feeling of having been chosen by someone. You know what I mean? It's like that's something that I never, even when I was in successful relationships, one in particular, I still didn't feel chosen. I felt, you know, I almost felt like it was a convenience more than anything. I've never felt special enough to be specifically chosen by one person to spend the rest of their lives with me. And so basically it was a woe is me, self-pitying kind of tune, but which doesn't apply anymore because I've since married, but, you know, it's still valid.
The songs are about you. They're not about characters who have these situations.
Exactly. Even the song Charlie, which is inspired by Charles Crumb, that song is not about Charles Crumb. It's called Charlie, but it's really about me. So,
could you talk?
And,
go on.
I'm sorry. I was just going to expound on that in stark contrast to my last CD, which was Many Worlds Are Born Tonight. That CD was personal in a different way, where that was more about fantasy and characters, and it was just, a lot of that was really outside of myself.
Could you talk a little bit more about Charlie?
Well, I guess, I don't know, I think I was very very moved in a weird way by the documentary Crumb, which is about Robert Crumb, the famous cartoonist, and, you know, all different aspects of his life was covered in that documentary, including the lives of his two brothers. And they did not have a particularly happy life and childhood, I should say. It was kind of, you know, they all wound up having a bit of strangeness to them. And I'm trying to be kind here.
Yeah, it's a very unsettling at times documentary.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, very unsettling. And it's something I can really identify with. Now, it's not to say that I can identify. I mean, Robert Crumb is, he's a weird dude, okay? But he found a place in life. He found some place to be acceptable and to get out his demons, whatever they are, and do that thing. His other brothers, Max and Charlie, I don't think they successfully found their places, and they had a lot of demons, that's for sure. And I felt so, I don't know, just very moved by the sadness. And I just felt like I had the kind of childhood, you know, certain things about my past where I could have wound up, you know, like Charlie. I could have wound up not having the happy life that I have. I feel like I'm, you know, well-adjusted and successful, at least enough for me, and I feel happy. But it could have gone in such the other direction, and that's what Charlie's about.
Well, where can people find me? CD Baby and other venues?
Sure. CD Baby has it right now, and, you know, it just usually takes them a while to get everything scanned and get everything up and running, so it should be any day now where they're making it available. I don't have it on my website yet, but I hope to have it up there soon. I'm trying to get my website overhauled, reworked, and so it's not for sale there yet, but everything else is still for sale there.
Okay. Will it be available digitally, do you know, through eMusic or iTunes?
Mm-hmm, yep.
Happy, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate
you're very welcome.
Sitting down with me, and I hope that everyone who is listening will run to CD Baby and Find Me will be available. I love it. It's one of my favorite CDs of the year.